Are we ready?
I feel ready.
All right.
What are we doing?
It's a podcast called The Three Questions.
Oh.
You haven't listened?
To what? To
the
this?
The podcast of mine called The Three Questions.
No, of course I've heard it.
Oh, well, all right.
I love it.
Well, great. Thank you. I like your podcast, too.
Thanks,
the
pal.
Improvised ones. I'm too scared to do improv.
Hey, wait. When is this going to be heard by people?
How should I know?
You don't know? Do you know?
Huh?
What?
Next week.
Interesting.
Wow. Get it hot off
the
presses.
Maybe I'll make news then and announce my new podcast.
Oh, that's exciting. Do it right now.
Shall I do it right
now? Yeah. This is the show has started.
Oh, okay.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Three Questions. Andy Daly is my guest.
Oh, hi.
I mean, you knew that because it says it right on the fucking screen. When you push on play, it says Andy Daly.
So. Well, sometimes the podcast will just start and you haven't chosen to start it. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. All that's right. True.
Anyhow.
Autoplay.
It happens to me sometimes.
What breaking news.
My podcast, the Andy Daly Podcast Pilot Project Podcast.
Yes.
Project. As you know, there's a character of mine named Dalton Wilcox who has tried his hand at two podcast pilots. And believe it or not, one of them got picked up. And so we are recording it now. It is called Bananas for Bonanza with Dalton Wilcox. And in each episode, he focuses on one episode of the classic television Western Bonanza.
Thank God for MeTV. Is that where you're getting them from?
No, they're all on YouTube. I don't know why.
Oh, wow.
I wonder every time. I'm just – every episode of Bonanza is on YouTube.
Do you watch the MeTV? You know what I'm talking about?
I don't know what that is.
It is – it's a channel that – what used to be UHF. You know how
–
you know, for kids out there, it used to – TV used to just be 2 through
– well, you had –
I think 13.
You had channel 2, 4 – 5, yeah. 7, 9, 11, and 13 in New York.
I think 13 ended up being like
that was PBS.
And that was VHF. High frequency.
For me, 13 was PBS, and then you had a separate dial for the UHF channel.
That's what I'm saying. That beyond 13, it had a separate dial, which was UHF, which was your shitty channels.
That was like somehow like 100 channels, but you could only clearly tune in about 5 of them.
Right, exactly. You had to like move the actual antenna to get them.
Yeah.
But that was like – that's where they would show the reruns of the Brady Bunch, you know, 8 times a day. And it was all old reruns. And old movies, and that's where your kind of creature feature stuff.
Yeah.
So MeTV, I think it's like channel 20 here if you had a regular TV, it'd be on channel 20. Mm. And it is just old TV.
Wow.
It's just Columbos and Kojaks and MASHes and My Mother the Car and fucking Dragnet. Just like – and it is such like a palliative to just like feel like I'm just gonna watch this episode of Canon you know about an obese private detective or Barnaby fucking Jones
Jones.
All I'm these sure they really have old the, shows. Love Boat, you know Charlie's Angels, Wonder Woman, like all you know like the Linda Carter Wonder
the Incredible
Woman.
Hulk.
The Incredible Hulk is on there sometimes, too. But it's just – it's like I watch it show. All the time, you know.
But I'm sure the commercials are modern commercials, huh?
Oh, yeah.
If they had the old commercials on there, that would be amazing.
It's fantastic because like the Wonder Woman, like I hadn't seen Wonder Woman since I was a child, the Linda Carter woman. And Linda Carter has – I mean I'm not – you know – she's a buxom, beautiful woman.
Yes.
But beyond that, she has the most winning, charismatic energy.
Wow.
I don't think I
ever watched
Why
Wonder
isn't she,
Woman.
Yeah. I mean, I know. I think it was like, it was either for post-pubescent boys or girls. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I don't think I was either one of those things at the time. But what's hilarious is that, like, her main accomplice is Lyle Waggoner.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I was watching one episode, and they parachuted in to, like, some evil guy's island where he was literally trying to control the weather. And literally, that was their plot point. And they parachuted in. Lyle Wagner was wearing a sports shirt open at the collar with gold chains, Sansibelt slacks, and zip-up boots. And she was wearing like a blouse like tied at the center.
Oh, she's trying to blend in. Yeah, or something
They looked like they were going to lunch. Oh. And she had high heels on. She had like heels on, and she's parachuting in. In high heels. And not only – they weren't, like, trying to blend in. It's a military encampment. And they were just wearing, like, casual clothes, you know.
What was Lyle Wagner's job in her
world? He was, like, a secret agent that, you know, facilitated –
Because I wondered why he was a famous person now. Because I would see him on Carol Burnett, and it would be kind of – and Lyle Wagner.
Yeah.
I'd be like, what?
He just was a handsome sort of utility player here.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And now people – I don't know how – a lot of people know this, but he now virtually every – rental
trailer
in town is his.
Yeah, I think about whenever I'm in one of those Verde trailers, which are the nice ones.
Yeah, yeah.
I am thinking like, I don't know if this is Lyle. I think this is Lyle's competition, and I feel bad. I have no idea if he's still with us.
The life of living in a trailer. I mean, it's really fun, but they sure do run the gamut. They're very heavy on the Southwest motif.
Yeah, that's for sure. Bones of steers and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of cow skull art and sort of, you know, Navajo print.
My big beef with trailers is I want someplace to sit and eat my breakfast where I don't have to stare at myself in a mirror.
Oh.
That's all I want out of a trailer.
Right, right, right.
Some place to sit with a table that's not right in front of a mirror.
You could request that they like spray paint it black or tape up things. So
I'm like one big gig away from being able to say something like that. And have been for 20 years.
Yeah. when I was on the show Quintuplets, I was in a trailer, and it was a tube banger, as they call it. It was halved, and on the other half was Rebecca Kreskoff, my TV wife, and mine, the roof of it, the ceiling of it, was covered in black mold.
Oh, that's not good.
Yeah, and I kept saying, because, you know, I'm not a, well, at the time, I mean, now I would say something, but at the time, I'd say to, like, the Teamsters, because it's Teamsters that are in charge. There's a lot of mold on the ceiling of my trailer. And they'd be like, all right, we'll look at it. And then nothing happened. Mm-hmm. And about 4 weeks in, like one of the production managers had something she wanted to ask me. Mm-hmm. And she stepped into my trailer. She knocked and I said, yeah, come in. She stepped in and she went, oh, my God, the ceiling of this trailer.
It's pulsating.
She's like, oh, my God. And I was like, yeah, I've been saying stuff. And she's like, this just can't be. And like the next day there was a brand new one because it's like a grown-up saw it.
Right.
You know.
Someone who has respect for you, yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had another trailer on another show that literally smelled like shit.
Oh, yeah.
Smelled like someone had just freshly dumped in there constantly. And I would tell the transpo guys and they go, okay, we'll check it out. Mm. And then they'd say, we took care of it. And I go back. And what they had done is taken a can of raspberry-scented air freshener.
Just emptied it.
And just emptied it. So it smelled like shit with, like, raspberry syrup on it. And that ended up being, like, the entire plumbing system was full of rot and mold one. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's rough.
Anyhow.
Oh, well.
Where are you from?
Huh?
You and I have known each other for a million years, and I haven't buttered you up yet, but you're one of my favorite people on earth.
Oh my God!
And that's not just because you're a brilliantly funny person, but you're also one of the most genuinely kind and moral people that I know.
Hmm.
Which is why it's all the more striking that most of your characters are just fucking creeps.
Yeah,
angry pervert creeps.
Yeah, horrifying monsters.
How does that happen?
Yeah.
When you started coming up with pervert creeps, were you aware of like, oh, this might be some off-gassing?
No, I don't think so. I mean, but it might be.
Yeah,
but I think I think it began from a understanding that when I take the stage, I look like Howdy Doody.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And then realizing that it would be fun.
To be gross.
Yeah, to start out that way and then to surprise the audience by taking a turn into something dark or disgusting or disturbing or whatever.
Yeah.
And I just really have always enjoyed playing with that. But then, you know, I have since come to understand that, like, narcissism is a real topic for me. Like, it's really – I'm very, very interested in narcissism. And, you know, Meryl Marco has written a lot about narcissism, and she has really pointed out that some of our favorite comic characters are narcissists.
Uh-huh.
Like
virtually every
yes.
Bill Murray character.
Yeah.
Every Bill Murray character is a fucking prick.
Yeah. I mean, every sitcom has a, you know, like, obviously George Costanza is a perfect example of like a total narcissist, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah.
And so she has, I think it's a web, I don't know if she's still doing it, but called Narcissists Say the Darndest Things, where people can kind of send in things that narcissists have said to them that are so ridiculous, but they truly mean it. And it's something that a character would say in a comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah. So anyway, that all sort of got me thinking about the inherent hilariousness of people who are just into their own thing mm-hmm. and have been so unwilling to see other people that they have become delusional, you know, which
yeah,
I think happens.
Yeah.
And we see it with the president, who's like a poster child for narcissistic personality
yeah.
disorder. He's just, he is so immune to critical thinking and information that is not of his own creation that that he's no longer in touch with the
yeah,
world.
There's
that
no
the rest
truth other than just what makes him feel good.
Yeah. Yeah, you remember that book, The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen?
Yes,
there's
yes.
One...
Never read it.
Oh, okay.
I've got a very bad thing with attention span and reading.
Me too.
Yeah,
big
yeah.
Big time. But
yeah.
So every once in a while, I'll power through a book. And,
good for you.
This was a long time ago. I read that book, and there's a line in there. One of the characters says something about, I forget all the context, but that his parents brought him into the world without asking his opinion, which that really struck a chord with me. And I really do think that, like, for our own purposes, my wife and I created these two people and brought them into this place. And, like, I owe them an apology for that. You know what I mean? Like,
but it's not that bad.
It's not that bad.
Yeah,
but it does
Glendale's
make me,
all right.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I think – but I do feel like I invited you to a party. I think I'd better accommodate you to some extent.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
I don't think that that was the sensibility that my parents had, who were just like, you know, we're creating a family and the family is doing this and we go to church on Sundays and you play baseball on Saturday. This is what we're doing and you got to get with it.
Yeah.
And what, you know, you can't tie your shoes. figure it out.
Yeah,
you know
yeah,
what
yeah.
I mean? Stuff like that. As opposed to like, if one of my kids is really late to learn how, I didn't learn how to tie my shoes until I was 27.
Tell the story about playing basketball. Fucking love this story.
Oh, I must have told that recently. I could not learn. There were two things I could not learn how to do. Tell time and tie my shoes. And both of them were when I was taught, quote unquote, to do them, I wasn't ready.
Scattered. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
And it was so frustrating to me that I then, for a long time, said, forget it. I'm not going to try to know how to do that. And so my shoes, I just like asked somebody to double knot them and then slip them on and off all the time for a long time. And then I was
till like what?
I figured out my own way of tying shoes in probably like late in high school. And
wow.
Then, yeah. And it was not until literally I was 27 years old and the woman who is now my wife, we were talking about the fact that like I never really properly learned how to tie my shoes and she showed me.
That is hot. Oh my God, that is hot. Probably after that, it was just madness. Just all four walls.
But yeah,
is that why you married her? Just because I've exposed myself to this woman now?
Pretty much. We need to keep this bond of trust between us.
You be quiet. You're sworn to secrecy.
I know if we break up, the first thing she's going to tell everybody is, you know, I taught him how to tie his shoes.
Oh my God. Yeah. And there's Velcro too. You could have just like,
I did the Velcro thing for a little while, but that's,
Exactly. You just feel like a retiree.
Yeah.
But tell me about
So I was on a basketball team and as a kid, you know, and I wasn't any good.
Great.
I was like 9 or 10. I was at least 10 because we were living in the new house, 10 or 11. So, and, yeah, and our team did well, no thanks to me, but we were, you know, in the big, like, final game, and this was all the parents came to it, and this gymnasium was super crowded, and my shoe came untied, and I think the ref blew his whistle, like, whoa, stop, we got an untied shoe, and the expectation amongst all the hundreds of people watching this is that I'm going to bend down and tie my shoe, but I had to say to the ref, I don't know how to tie my shoe.
Oh, my God.
And right at the center of the court, he had to get down and tie my shoe for me. And it was, I remember that.
Wow.
It was memorable.
That is just like, oh my God. It just, you know, that's got to be in a movie sometime because, oh my God, who cannot relate to like, oh yes, my greatest fear in front of an entire gymnasium. Oh, that's so hilarious.
And then telling time, I was a junior in high school, and I wore a digital watch. I asked my parents for a digital watch a long time before that. And I was just like, you know, I have been avoiding looking at clocks. Like, truly, I don't look at them.
Yeah.
And I was sitting in a classroom, and I was bored, and I was like, all right, you know what? And it took courage. I remember it taking courage. And I said, I'm going to look at that clock. Every room I'm in all day has a clock on the wall, and I'm studiously avoiding looking at it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to look at it and figure out what's going on there. And within a minute, you know, right, it's obvious what's happening on a clock.
Yeah.
But it did make me think, like, in a way, why teach a young child how to do that at a point when it's challenging to their brain? At some point, they'll look at it and know what it's doing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And also, too, it does, like, there's no reason that every clock in the world isn't digital.
That's true.
There's just no reason.
That is true.
That's, you know, nowadays. Mm-hmm. It's just purely aesthetic, but, you know.
Yeah. But anyway, when I think about, like, my childhood and the fact that I was a kid with those kinds of issues, I think I was probably a kid that needed some individualized attention.
I don't know.
Yeah, right? Like, and plus I now know that I have ADD, and so that all through school. And so,
how was homework? Because I couldn't do homework.
Yeah. Well, no, I didn't really do homework.
Third, fourth grade or what, it would have been third or fourth because the house we lived in. Mm-hmm. But like my mother set up in our unfinished basement a desk against a cement wall. Mm. So there'd be absolutely no distraction. And I'd sit there with just dumb fucking worksheets. At the time, I knew, like, oh, yeah, this is no big deal. Mm-hmm. And I just could not do it. I'd go like, okay, I'd work up this nerve, like, okay, come on. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I probably was down there for an hour and a half, but it felt at the time like every night was 6 hours of just existential struggle of why am I so broken that I can't do this thing? And then I go, come on, you're going to do it. Okay, first question, you know, whatever the fuck it is. And like, okay, do this. And then like, oh my God, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
It's awful. I can't do it.
And, yeah.
It was just ridiculous, you know?
Me too. But my parents sort of took the opposite approach in a way, which is my dad is a huge TV fan. And so the TV was always on. And then I was given a TV for my own room.
Wow.
And a desk to do homework. But it was a little tiny black and white TV. And I would just go up there and watch TV all night. And, you know, they were furious about my grades all the time.
Yeah.
But at no point did anybody say, we're taking the TV away.
Right. Were you flunking or was it C's and D's? And
yeah, a lot of C's and D's. And sometimes there'd be an F. But yeah, I was just always completely lost in math and science, never knew what the hell was going on, and just really late and, you know, 100 pages behind in the book that everybody's reading in English and 3 weeks late with the history paper and all that stuff. I just could not do the things.
And were either of your siblings this way?
I don't think, maybe my little brother is 8 years younger than me, and so I'm a little, I don't really know quite all the aspects of his experience, but my older brother was on the ball, I think. think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got good grades. And,
he got good grades.
Do you think being a middle kid has anything to do with, like, you know, like who you are as, you know, kind of a people pleaser, you know, I mean, as someone who aligns yourself with, you know, do you think that that middle child, were you, did you serve that sort of like middle child keeping everybody happy role in your house?
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And my older brother used to really argue with my parents, and he used to fight for things, which that I would then benefit from. and, you know, like, for instance, when he decided he didn't want to do Sunday school anymore, he laid out the case to my parents and duked it out and argued it and won. And then I, 3 years younger than him, also no longer had to go to Sunday school anymore. So I got out of it 3 years earlier than him.
Wow.
The kind of thing that just like sticks in his craw a little bit, even to this day, I think. But I didn't have to ever play that role in the house. I could just be... I could be Mr. Friendly.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it was a big deal to, at the age of eight, go from the baby and the pest and the funny, to now.
The darling.
Yeah, to now there's a new baby.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. And then when you're like, and then when you're like 14, he's six, and you're like really cute.
Yeah.
yeah. And you're just all misshapen, big ears and big nose and
Yeah, and we had to get rid of our dog when he was born, and we had to move when he was born, and, you know. Yeah.
Really? Why get rid of the dog? The dog was a baby biter?
Yes, actually.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. oh, that dog loves biting babies.
The story of this dog, I think this is a very 70s thing. Like, we were allergic to a cat, and so my parents decided to get a poodle, right? Like a hair dog.
Right.
A fur dog. And so my dad went through the classified section of the paper and found somebody who was, like, getting rid of their poodle, and we went to go pick up this dog, and it was a married couple and their child, who was a year or two older than me, and he was not on board with getting rid of the dog at all, to the point where he locked himself in the bathroom with the dog, whose name was I.W. Harper III. Which
Jesus
is
Christ.
But that's a licker, I.W. Harper.
It is?
Yeah. And and this is the third dog they named after licker?
Yeah,
I guess.
so, other two just, I don't know what happened to them.
so somehow the dad gets the dog out from behind the bathroom door, and we brought it home, and he liked my dad but didn't like anybody else, and would growl and sort of snap at me anytime I tried to be affectionate to him. My parents say we had the dog for 3 years, but we have one photo of it. I can't believe it was 3 years. But anyway, the day that my dad – the baby is coming, and it's clear that the dog is going to bite the baby. and so my dad puts an ad in the classifieds. We're getting rid of this poodle, and some guy shows up to give it to his mother-in-law. and I lock myself in the bathroom with the dog thinking, like, well, this is what you do
when
they come to take your dog away. but my heart wasn't in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And my dad was just like, come on.
Come on. You know you're not that sad. Yeah,
this is not
– Yeah, yeah. That's crazy to me. Like, yeah, we want a dog. Here's one.
Yeah. I don't know.
No sort of like vetting in any way. Like, maybe you should check out if it won't bite your child.
I don't know if that was a 70s thing. We'll find a dog in the classified section. Seems strange to me.
Now, as a kid, are you a performer? Or are you, I mean, does that start to come out? Are you a performer at home? Are you like the funny one?
I used to put on tap dance shows on the hearth. I was a big Gene Kelly fan.
Nice.
And, I tried
real
to be...
Real tap shoes or just fake
no,
tap
I
shoes?
No, I didn't have real tap
shoes.
And then at school, I liked to be funny, and I also really liked to make the teachers laugh. Like, that to me was my favorite thing. And so in first grade, this teacher recommended that I take a drama class because I was, you know, I was a ham. And I didn't take that drama class because I imagined myself in wearing tights and singing somehow. And I didn't want to do either of those things.
Whereas now, try and get you out of the tights and stop you from singing.
I think it's because we went to see Peter Pan on Broadway, and Sandy Duncan was up there in these tights and singing and stuff. And I was just like, well,
that's what it is.
I don't want to do that.
not a real man like me. Yeah. not a he-man like me.
But that production of Peter Pan was very memorable to me because Captain Hook, at some point in the show, he's out in front of the curtain with Smee, probably while they're changing over from the nursery to the Neverland.
Ship or whatever.
Yeah. And he's given a speech kind of directly to the audience or whatever. And he says, I'm going to get that Peter Pan. And a little boy in the audience yelled, no, you're not. And he, or no, you won't. And he goes, oh, yes, I will. And the place went bananas for this one like little minor unscripted moment. And it was so exciting.
Yeah.
And I remember it to this day of just like, he was so in character. He seemed like he was expecting it. It didn't throw him for one second. It was an amazing moment. And I later, my mom keeps all the playbills. And I saw recently that that was James Hewitt, who would go on to replace Hervé Villechaize on Fantasy Island and then play Mr. Belvedere.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And at the time that he played Captain Hook, he was like Royal Shakespeare Company. He had an amazing resume at that time.
Yeah.
Anyway, that, that stuck in my mind.
That was your first notion that you wanted to be an improviser.
Yeah, I think so, actually. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
John Waters says that that Captain Hook was his first gay role model. Captain Hook in the Disney movie.
It's well, like, you know that.
Yeah, that's pretty. Yeah.
Very, very funny James Adomian bit about gay villains.
Yes,
oh,
yes.
My God.
Or remember when you and I took our daughters to Disneyland and it was gay day.
Yes.
And the only characters we saw were all the villains.
They brought out all the villains
on
gay day.
Yeah, it was Captain Hook and Ursula.
Uh-huh.
And
Maleficent.
And Maleficent and the one from Cruella de Vil.
Right.
And I was like, this has got to be design.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah, they know what they're doing. They know their audience. And and I said something about it online because we were tweeting about it.
Oh, yeah. We were live tweeting our
Gay day. Our accidental gay day.
Right.
which another thing I loved is about three times moms came up to you about your daughter to say, does she have sunscreen? Like, you stupid gay dad don't know that your fair daughter will roast in the sun. Does she have sunscreen?
I am well aware of the problem.
Yeah. She is slathered, ma'am. But I said something about the villains, and there were people that were just absolutely indignant about that. Like, no, they do. Like, why wouldn't they?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so were you in plays in school? Did you start performing like that? I mean, are you?
Yeah, well, there was some play in third grade, and then I was the fire truck in the Velveteen Rabbit in fifth grade,
right?
And I improvised a little bit on the show night. And
yeah, wow.
I did. I did. My one line got a laugh, and then I said something like, "Yeah, I made a comment out of character about how funny I thought the line was too."
Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, something like that. And then, I was in junior high. I was in the play every year and took a drama class in junior high. I was just kind of always doing that.
Yeah.
However, my high school did five plays a year, which is kind of
Jesus
incredible.
Christ.
Yeah, there was a guy from another town this guy named Brian Ashinger, who was like, 6'5" and obese and just this booming voice. And he taught music at some other school, and he would come to our school after school every day and put up five good productions.
Wow.
And my sophomore year was my first year at high school for stupid reasons, but they—
Public high school?
Yeah, public high school.
Yeah.
And I was in four of the five shows, and I was the lead in one. But my grades were so bad that my parents forbade me from doing theater.
Oh, wow.
After that, they told me I couldn't do it anymore. And so that's when I started to we also had a television production class at my high school. The local cable access was located in the high school. And so there was a switcher and there were cameras and a makeshift studio. And that's when I started doing that in my after school hours, which because I was making my own schedule now. It wasn't like I have to be at rehearsal and there's a play that you're going to find out about. It was like acting and writing on the sly.
Yeah.
You know?
And you were doing schoolwork. You were working after school on schoolwork.
Sure. That's, yes.
Yeah. I mean, to your as yes, far as your
right.
parents knew.
It's a study group. I know there's a study group, and we work very hard, really getting those grades up there. I don't know if it'll be reflected in the report card, but we're really working hard.
So junior, senior year, there are no plays at all. Just the TV production stuff.
Yeah.
And was it theatrical stuff, or was it more sort of like in this morning's lunch lady news?
It was there was some of that. I did a game show that was a total. total ripoff of Remote Control. Remember Remote Control? Like a comedy game show. And then, you know, Andy Blitz and I went to high school together. And we both did.
Oh, I didn't know
Oh,
that.
You didn't know that?
I did not know
Andy
that.
Andy Blitz and I graduated.
Andy Blitz is a comedy writer. He was a Conan writer and has gone on to do lots of different things and worked on
Review
on your show. Yeah.
Yeah. He and I were buddies in high school. We
very met funny guy. Tenth, yeah.
Very funny. Oh, my God. Yeah. We met in 10th grade. And then and so he and I collaborated on sketch comedy and made sketch shows.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. On video.
That's funny that you, it was Andy and Andy, because the first time I knew you, you were working with Andy Secunda.
Right. Just, I know.
How many Andys?
So that's all.
And here we are. Mm-hmm. Making podcast magic, the two Andys again.
The two Andys again.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm only interested in people named Andy. I don't have anything in common with people who have weird other names.
You're gunning for Sandberg now. He will accept me.
Yes.
So you and Andy are doing that, and do you kind of keep doing that through high school and then out of high school?
Yeah. So I had no interest in going to college.
At all?
No, but then I read a biography.
What were you going to do?
I didn't know. I just knew that, like, I didn't want to be sitting in a classroom anymore because I was not good at that, you know. I didn't know what I was going to do. My parents were adamant that I go to college.
Sure.
But I didn't have any plans or thoughts until I read this biography of David Letterman that said he went to college for television and radio, for communications, which I didn't know was a thing. Mm-hmm. And so I told my parents I could see myself doing that, and they were thrilled. And so I ended up going to Ithaca College because it has a television and radio program, a good communications program, which I did not get into because my grades weren't good enough. But I was in proximity to that world of there was a sketch comedy show at college and I did that. And that's where I met Andy Secunda and John Bowie. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah. He was also on that show. Yeah.
And so you never actually did. What was your major then?
My major started off as English, and my plan was to transfer into the School of Communications.
When you got your grades up?
Yeah, yes. But my first semester grades, I will never forget, my first semester GPA was a 1.48.
Oh, my.
And so that ended that. I was never going to be able to transfer into the School of Communications.
Oh, gosh.
I had taken an acting elective, and I really enjoyed it. And so I was just like, well, I guess I'll audition for the theater department. And I did. I got in there.
And they don't care about your grades.
They didn't care about the grades.
Yeah, yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I graduated. I was in the BFA program for a little while, but I ended up graduating with a BA in drama.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the difference between the BFA and the BA?
Well, the BFA.
There, at least.
It was.
At Ithaca.
It was sort of created as kind of a acting studio kind of. It was just basically you were moving into the theater building. You were there all the time. You were taking scene study classes and you were helping out on the crew and you were just fully immersed in that.
Yeah.
And that didn't work for me because I had been there a year already making friends in other departments who were, you know, and I wanted to be over at the, you know, the School of Communications making my sketch show and being in student films.
Right.
And that's where the funny people were, you know, the funny people were making movies.
Did Joel Kim Booster go to Ithaca, do you know?
I don't know.
Because he has a similar story that I think in college there was sort of the higher echelon. And I think it doesn't matter. It was causing me deja vu because I think he had a very similar thing where he was like, yeah, I'd like to be in there. It seems more prestigious, but it doesn't seem as much fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think a lot of comedy people who go to college, like all those people who went to Emerson College and all that stuff, like they studied television, radio, and film. Like the funny, that's where the funny people are
there. Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's where I wanted to be.
Yeah, I think that, I went to film school and it's probably very much the case because I also thought about being in the drama, but it's like, I don't know. And I took a couple of acting classes, maybe only one, maybe a couple of, I'm trying to pad my resume. I think maybe it was just one. And it just seemed so silly and boring and not the kind of stuff I was interested in. And then when I got to film school, I realized, and I still feel this way, like, I don't, you know, being on stage it's okay. Mm-hmm. But what I really want to do is act in television and motion pictures. And that's the kind of acting that's the technique I'm interested in learning how to do better. Uh-huh. Not on Broadway, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
No, I have no idea.
Doing Long Day's Journey and Tonight or anything. No, I'd rather like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'd rather be on season two of The Outsider.
Yeah, and that the theater department at Ithaca College is very focused on New York theater as like what we're training you for.
Sure.
You know, understandably. And I was, I was always just like, well, that's not
what I'm. What were your folks – what was their attitude as you're going through this?
They did not think that I should be an actor. I think they liked the idea of me getting a degree in communications, which would set me up to be like, I don't know, ad sales at a radio station or something, like
something
a job.
Like that. Yeah,
you know
what
I mean?
Working in a newsroom.
Yeah. But at the point it was, I came home with a 1.48 grade point average. It was like, well, whatever it takes, you know? And so I was just like, well, they'll take me in this program. And so they just said, fine. And then, they got me a subscription to Backstage as a gift when I graduated college as a kind of a, but my dad also bought me a suit as a ritualistic buying of a suit when you graduate college.
Uh-huh.
I think, I don't think they particularly wanted me to. To pursue this,
and what was your plan? Did you have
solid plan? When I was around about my senior year or so, I kept reading about basically what you were up to in Chicago, like the Annoyance Theater and Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, you know, the and Improv Olympic. Like there were articles being written about that kind of improv comedy boom of 1992-93. And I had read Janet Coleman's book on the Compass Players and Something Wonderful Right Away, and of course Wired, the John Belushi biography, and that section about Second City. And so I had become really steeped in all of that. My plan was to move to Chicago and just get fully involved in all of that. But I was in debt, and so I moved into my parents' basement in New Jersey. And while I was just trying to pay off credit card advances and get enough money to move to Chicago, I got involved in what New York improv scene there was and started doing stand-up. And then I think kind of stupidly felt at the point at which I had enough money to move that I had put down too many roots in New York already. But I'd only been there for like a year and a half meeting people and doing stuff. But I just felt like I can't at this point in my life and my career pick up and move to another city.
Well, it was also kind of starting to percolate there too.
In New York, it was, it was start. I mean, that was, I graduated in 93 and the UCB didn't come to New York until 96. And so prior to that, it was all short form and like very game show, talk show, sketch comedy.
Yeah.
But I was doing that and stand up, you know. There was a lot of like, if you get five good minutes, you can get $1 million development deal type of stuff going on. So I was trying to do that. But it was not until the UCB came to town that some things really started to explode.
Yeah.
Can't you tell my love's a growing?
Now, Beck, like in college while you're doing, like, are you like a party guy at all? Or, I mean, because you never have been as far as I've known you.
Well,
tandem with these bad grades, are you fucking around? Are you
quit drinking in 2001.
Uh-huh.
Prior to that, it was a big part of my life.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about this recently in some big... Because I was under 21 a lot of the time that I was drinking, and it was once you leave the dorm room, it can be difficult to know, like, how am I going to get drunk out in the world, you know? So I had this habit of getting blind drunk in my room before heading out.
Before you even go out,
which is so fucking stupid. And I was blackout drunk, like, every time, every weekend night, because I just obliterated myself before I even left the dorm.
Yeah.
You know? So yes, that was part of it.
And I mean, how is your romantic life? How is this impacting your romantic life?
Oh,
are you having girlfriends at all during this time?
No. Not really. Not until senior year, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I felt like I was so much in the scrum of like, you know, jockeying for friends and for prominence on this sketch comedy show and just like all of that. I was in the world of and then being hammered every weekend.
That's what I would think, like, getting that drunk on a consistent basis. doesn't make you a very sparkling conversationalist.
Nope.
I think, yeah.
No. Then, yeah, college girls are not really looking to take on that kind of project.
But now the world's your oyster. When you got out, what did you have when you were making that money to settle down those debts? Mm. What kind of job is that?
Oh, man. Well, first I waited tables at Bennigan's.
Yeah.
In Englewood, New Jersey.
Lots of buttons on your, did you have like a vest?
No, this was after buttons. They were trying to be a little classier.
Oh, I see.
It was khakis and white shirts.
Oh, nice.
Yes, covered in barbecue sauce.
Of course. White shirts, great idea.
I remember I used to have to iron the shirt, and as I was ironing the shirt before my shift, the room just reeked of barbecue sauce. I'm just heating up the barbecue sauce stains on the shirt. that was a terrible job.
Yeah.
It sounds like a joke, but when I first got there, the orientation from the general manager, he said to all these kids who were planning to wait tables at Bennigan's, he goes, my wife left me. I'm not allowed to see my kids. I'm living in an apartment over a laundromat. I got nothing in my life except this Bennigan's, and this is going to be the best Bennigan's in the country. And if you are on board with that, welcome aboard. And if not, get out.
And, wow.
And nobody cared about making that the best Bennigan's anywhere.
Of course not.
No.
Yeah, well, I had I waited tables at a restaurant. It was a chain. A Mexican chain called Casa Lupita, which was like a step up from Chi-Chi's, which was our other local Mexican chain.
Yeah.
And it was the same kind of thing where you'd get these talks about like, aren't you serious about making Casa Lupita the best brand it can be? And I'm like, no.
Absolutely
I'm
not.
I'm 20 years old and I don't give a fuck about any of this. I just want the tips.
I'm trying to figure
out. They're not that good.
Yeah. And we figured out how to drink beer on the job at Bennigan's. You know what I mean?
There was, coffee cups or something?
Yes, coffee cups. At this particular station where we could refill out of the keg. And so, yeah, I was mostly hammered. And then I got a job as the box office manager at a little equity theater in Teaneck, New Jersey.
Oh.
Which was where I learned that thing that people learn, which is like, it's bad to be in proximity to what I want to be doing, but not doing what I want to be doing.
Yeah.
That's not a good feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. You can only do that for so long.
And how long did you do that?
I was there less than a year. I was there probably nine months. And
Was it a good living to do that?
Yeah, it was actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was decent money. They paid me too much for what I was doing, which was mostly just sitting alone in a building, fiddling around with tickets, putting tickets in envelopes. It was like not much of a job.
Right.
Yeah.
And were you there for the shows or were you able to go into the city and do your shows?
I was always going into the city. Yeah. I was going into the city every chance I got. I had my dad's old Chevy Celebrity station wagon and would drive it into the city and take improv classes and do whatever.
Well, who was teaching improv back then?
Well, I got involved with this theater called Chicago City Limits on the Upper East Side.
Yeah. That's where I remember them. Yeah.
Yeah. That's where I was doing stuff.
Yeah, because they were just sort of like improv Olympic mirror image kind of thing.
Yeah. And I made it into their main stage company, which was we did six shows a week on the Upper East Side. And I was paid $200 a week, you know, so I actually was making money doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get paid more for a touring gig and stuff like that. I did that for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And did that well? Those shows were well attended.
Sometimes they were. Yeah. I mean, you know, from time to time we'd have to cancel the 10:30 show on Friday nights.
Sure.
Nobody was there.
Yeah.
But sometimes, they really were. They would bring in groups, and you know, because the company had been around since the late 70s.
Yeah.
And so they had networks of people who
were there bleed over from Chicago? Were there Chicago people that would come in and
No. The original founders came from Chicago and only one of them was left running the thing and the rest of them were all gone.
Oh no, but I mean like somebody coming from Chicago and saying, I'm gonna move to New York and here's something that's similar to what I was doing in Chicago.
I don't remember a lot of that actually.
Yeah,
it was mostly New York community. Sean Conroy was involved there. Paul Scheer was involved there as a college student. Other folks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the UCB comes around, mm-hmm. and I mean, does it kind of explode there? Because it sure felt like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw them at Luna Lounge and they did a bit that was really funny. You know, at that time, me and Andy Secunda were the two Andys and we were trying to do like, we were trying to get into the alternative comedy sketch world.
Yeah. I mean, I just had remember seeing the two Andys mm-hmm. and because I'm self-involved, I was like, there, that's got to, I got to stop that. but that alternative comedy world, it was funny to me because at the time mm-hmm. I had come from Chicago doing stuff in Chicago, but never anything. I never made any money at
yeah.
it. I mean, it would be like when we kind of had our own group, we'd sort of get beer money, or if we would get mm-hmm. a college date, we'd get some money for that, but nothing ever, you know, in any regular way.
Yeah.
And it always felt too removed from real show business.
Oh, yeah.
It was like our little regional, you know,
yeah,
fuck around.
Yeah, you're satisfying
gang.
Yourself yeah. entirely, yeah.
And then yeah. there was this show, The Real Life Brady Bunch. It went to mm. New York, went to LA. Mm-hmm. And that's, and again, it's removed from real show business, you know, because it's just like, yeah, they're fucking Brady Bunch episodes,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And they're funny, yeah, they're funny, but they're also like wildly popular for head scratching reasons. Like, I guess
this is not a commercial move.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and then I had done like I did a little movie, and then I was in Cabin Boy.
Yeah,
but when I got hired on Conan and came to New York, I was very. I was on fucking television.
Yeah,
but I was still like incredibly intimidated. Mm. By the notion of New York,
oh.
you know, and even kind of, and then there would be sort of, you know, the alternative comedy scene. And mm-hmm. I would sort of, and I remember I went once because my ex-wife was reading something at a thing mm-hmm. and John Hodgman, it was the first time I ever met John Hodgman.
Oh, wow.
And he was very nice and very funny, but I went and watched this thing that she did. And I just remember, it was like this revelation of like, because I, again, I was very intimidated. I felt like, oh, these are all really cool. Like,
you're already on Conan at that point?
I'm already on fucking television and I'm still insecure. And I go down and I think like, oh, this is all these New York people and they're all like, you know, like they're doing some kind of like real highbrow shit that I probably wouldn't even get. And then I get there and I realize, oh, they're just trying to be funny.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck.
Right.
Oh, my God. I know how to do that. And it was just like such a revelation. And then to yeah. have the UCB guys come
mm-hmm.
really was a blessing for me because I had like, I mean, and I, you know, especially early on in the Conan show, there was just no room left for anything else in your life.
Oh, yeah.
Very much. I mean, mm-hmm. I would come home and, you know, and my wife at the time, I still feel bad. I just have nothing left for,
mm-hmm.
like in terms of like just conversation
yeah, yeah.
or being alive. It would mm-hmm. just be like.
I need to zone
yeah,
out.
Yeah. And because it wasn't yeah. only that I was working with like really funny fucking people
yeah.
and like getting like exhausted. My funny was getting exhausted.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so I would come
just
home.
Keeping
and
just keeping up conversationally
yeah.
with a room full of hilarious,
absolutely.
Brilliant people.
And young yeah. people who don't know, like, who don't have any separation between their work identity and their personal identity.
Oh, yeah.
So it's all just, like, fucking mayhem. It's throwing trash cans downstairs.
Yeah.
It's, you know, writing, you know, big spurting dicks on the wall, like, mm-hmm. of the conference room.
Hiding sandwiches
there.
In the ceiling.
Hiding sandwiches in the ceiling. More than sandwiches, like, just tons of food up in the ceiling, up in the drop ceiling of the conference room. Just madness.
Uh-huh.
Dumping, we had a 5-gallon bucket full of little rubber balls, like that you get out of a vending machine, like the
Super Balls
or whatever.
Yeah,
yeah. A 5-gallon bucket of those that we had for a bit for some reason,
mm-hmm.
but it just sat around for a while. And then one night, it was probably about 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. We just dumped them onto Sixth Avenue from the 9th floor window. It was the fucking best, and you could just and it was hilarious because we had started during the day just like. Tossing one down because they would bounce and they'd bounce so
up to
high.
Like the 5th floor or something.
That like somebody would be walking down the street and then a ball would like bounce in front of them and it'd be like, where the fuck did that come from? But the whole bucket of them was just really.
What time was that? Was that?
Oh, that would be in the middle of the day. That'd be like
yeah,
when,
but when
streets
the whole bucket went down.
Oh, that was like 9 o'clock at night. Like
okay,
we wouldn't
right.
do that.
Yeah.
Like
no,
we're
no,
not
no,
going to do that like at rush hour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like we really
but
made
some
sure.
some people experienced that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
There were people that were like, and they had, I mean, I guess they could, look up and see us looking at them. But mostly it seemed like nobody knew where this hail, you know, it was probably like, you know, like the way there's a rain of frogs, but this was, you know, super balls.
Yeah. That would be weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
You would talk about that for the rest of your life. And at a certain point it would be like, I don't know if this really happened.
Yeah. And then we used to do shit like, you could still smoke cigarettes in that building when we first started working there. Mm-hmm. And then they shut it down. And then people would smoke in my office because I was smoking at the time, which I was not crazy about. Like,
but this is the smoker's lounge.
My office became the smoker's lounge. But it was part of the of a phenomenon that I never was anxious to change. Mm. But that was that. But it was a situation that existed that would. Worked to my deficit, which was the attitude, Andy won't mind.
Uh-huh.
You know? And there were so many things that would happen at the show in those days where it's like, we'll get Andy in the elaborate fucking uncomfortable costume.
Right.
We're not sure when Conan's coming or when the other actor's going to, but get Andy into that thing.
Yeah.
And he
never
mind.
Yells at anybody. We haven't seen him snap yet.
He'll be dressed as Imelda Marcos for 3 hours. He won't say anything because he's nice, you know?
Yeah. At a certain point, you do have to start.
Oh, yeah. You have to start being a dick.
Putting up some limits.
A little bit, yeah. Mm-hmm. But Tommy Blatcho, writer on the show, my friend, used to do a bit, and like people would come into the room and. And Tommy would be sitting at the window smoking a cigarette. And my bit was like, hey, have you met my new publicist? And Tommy would go, that's me. And then he would pull open a desk drawer next to me, like my desk drawer, and just take like 50 headshots of me and throw them out the window. Just throw them out the window onto 6th Avenue, fluttering down 50 of like, you know, me. And
really getting the word out there.
People would see like the way, you know, people would set stuff out to sell, like books and old purses and stuff.
Oh,
there'd be stacks of my headshots for sale that someone had just gathered up like, I can sell this.
Some have been run over by taxis, but there's still good.
And you started working on the show for us.
Yeah.
How did that start?
My understanding is I went to an audition for the Dana Carvey show.
Oh, okay.
I auditioned for the Dana Carvey show and I had a good audition and I got a call back, which I did not know what the callback was going to be, but it was just me sitting at a table with Dana Carvey and Robert Smigel and Dino and Louis C.K., and I think
Robert and Dino and Louis, for people that don't know, had been working on the Conan show just prior to this.
Right. And then they left to do the Dana Carvey show. And it was just, we're just chatting and I'm supposed to kind of go into whatever bits or voices or whatever things I can do at this table. And it was really weird. I mean, I know that they were trying to just be like, let's just have a casual hang with these prospective actors.
But they're judging you in some way.
Yeah, I just wasn't there. I wasn't like in a mental space to feel like, we're all equals, like creative people. I was 25 or 24 or something like that. So they did not hire me. But
and this was like an audition to be a cast member.
Yeah, to be a cast member on the Dana Carvey show.
And was that... And ostensibly what it was for, was that like overt that you knew that, or did you just think it was a chit chat?
No, because I had auditioned. I had put together like 5 minutes of character bits for an initial audition, and now this was the callback. So I thought I was there for an acting job, and I didn't get it. But Smigel, this is just the kind of person that Robert Smigel is. He sort of took note of me and talked me up to other places, and he called Conan Casting and was just like, you know, we didn't hire this guy for the Dana Carvey show, but he's funny. You should use him. And so I started getting used in Conan sketches.
Yeah.
So that was huge.
It was fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. It was a really, the UCB, those guys, those initial four original members, and then when they opened a theater and it opened it up to you guys, I mean, we really benefited from that because I've talked about it before in here. It was hard to find really, truly funny people.
Mm-hmm.
Like funny people in the way that we want them to be funny, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because that idea of like grounding the things that need to be grounded so that the funny things can be funny was not a new idea, but it was clarified by the UCB guys when they came to town and started talking about truth and comedy and the incongruous element and all that. It was what was happening in the alternative comedy scene. There were so many bits that were a plant in the audience, you know, like, like if you went to Rebar before Luna Lounge, you would see like three bits that had plants in the audience. Yeah, and it was all about like, how much can you fool me into thinking that this breakdown in your bit is actually happening? And so that was that idea of like, I'm really committing to this moment and I'm trying to ground it as best I can. And you needed that. You very often needed that at Conan. And so I'm not surprised that world, you know, spawned so many people who could do that. And I did a lot of bits that Glazer wrote, and so many of Glazer's bits are all about just the total deadpan.
Yeah, yeah. And
commitment to this reality.
Yeah.
And I had
John Glazer Delocate. What was it?
Yeah, Delocated.
Delocated. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Glazer Loves Gear. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And
very
one other
funny guy.
That's something about a werewolf.
Yeah. Oh, right. Mm-hmm. I can't remember.
I forget.
Look, Google it, people.
Yeah. Yeah. So funny.
And then from there was Mad TV the next thing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What year was that?
That was 2000, fall of 2000.
Okay.
Mad TV.
And how long it had been on? Did it just start?
No, Mad TV, I think, premiered in 96.
Okay.
Or 4. Maybe 90. Yeah, 94.
Yeah.
So this was the sixth season. That was a weird one.
That's what brought you to LA, correct?
That's what brought. Well, no, I had come out to do a pilot season. So 20 years ago today.
Oh, wow.
I was sitting in a duplex on Glendale Boulevard up the street from the Astro Family Diner, wondering why I wasn't getting any auditions. That was my pilot season.
Was it
in LA.
Just, did you take a rent out an apartment? Did you take a lease?
I was planning to stay in the guest room of an old high school friend who had apparently not run that by her live-in boyfriend.
Oh, boy.
And so I arrived and I slept there one night, and the next morning I hear this knock on the door and it's him saying, "Let's go find you an apartment." Like, oh, all right. So I ended up signing a year lease, and I only wanted to be there for like 2 or 3 months. And I had to buy a refrigerator and a stove and furnish it. I was like, what's happening? It was not the plan. And then I wasn't getting any auditions.
Yeah.
I would literally get dressed up in my best clothes and go down to the United Talent Agency and sit in the lobby waiting to see my agent face to face because she wasn't returning my calls.
Oh, my God.
Can you believe that? Don't do that, show business aspirants.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because sometimes they thought I worked there because I was dressed.
Right, right.
Nicely.
You were dressed too well to be talent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when they understood that I was an actor hoping to see my agent, they thought I was crazy. And I was.
Yeah.
That was a crazy thing to do.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But that was bad. And prior to that, I auditioned for SNL in the summer of 1999, and I really worked hard on my audition for that. I got that good. And then I auditioned for Mad TV, and they were like, yeah, come test for it. We want to hire you. And I didn't want to. I actually said no. I said no like 3 times. And then I had that miserable pilot season, and then I said, oh, yeah, I'll do that.
Did you think SNL was a possibility, and is that why you were kind of—
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
And how did SNL pan out? Just sort of— Tumbleweeds, or did you hear anything?
I did. I got good feedback. I heard that Garth and Seer liked me. I knew Adam McKay a little bit at that time, and he was like, yeah, I'm hearing good things about you. Don't fret that you haven't heard whether you're hired or not. They haven't decided anything. I was like, I'm in the mix. But then nothing. Yeah. Then the tumbleweeds.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And I was 28 at that time, and my agent told me, if anybody asks, you're 26.
I was like, what? Oh, my God. Why?
I don't know. And so
my God, like that.
But that planted the idea in my mind that, like, this is it. This is my shot. You know what I mean? I'm aging out of what they're looking for right now, apparently.
Yep.
So, when they didn't hire me, I was like, that's never happening.
Is that person still your agent?
No.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No. I wouldn't think so. Is that person still an agent?
Yeah.
Oh, God. So how was it? What was it like? Was
Mad TV?
Some kind of a culture shock? I mean,
yeah. It was a crazy time. I still struggle to contextualize it in my life and career, you know, because
it does seem different than like, you know, because the things that you've done, I mean, aside from Review, but, you know, just the things that you've been in, I mean, aside from the Yogi Bear movie, but you know, like I just was watching the Eastbound and Down or the Eastbound and Down pilot, and just like that, you know, to be a part of that, you know, it's just like there's, you've done some like really. Like work that's within your own kind of ethos, you know what I mean?
Yes, I have. I've been very lucky to be able to do that. That's correct. And so Mad TV was not quite that.
Yeah.
And that's why, even though I had no job and no prospects and no plans, I said no to it three times because I knew. Like, I watched it and said, I don't know what I would do on that show. I really don't. But they persisted, and I had nothing going on. So you know, when I took the job, the way the contract was structured, they were offering me four episodes for $28,000 for four episodes, which is sounds nice, but it's not television money, people.
Wait, four, 28 grand total?
Yes.
Or oh, wow.
28 for all
yeah,
four
that's,
episodes.
Yeah.
You know, but
and
I was,
once, and once, every, and just so people know, once the agent and whoever gets a piece of that, it's very
– yeah.
You know, it's 40 cents on the dollar or something like that. So.
And by the way, so it's like an agent and a lawyer, both of whom called me and said, we weren't able to nudge them $1.
Oh, yeah. I've been, yeah.
But we still expect to,
yeah, of course.
15%
between two of us.
Just like, okay. But so I thought I'm just going to go there and I'll collect that money and I'll do these four episodes and I'll get the fuck out of there and go on with the rest of my life. But something happened when I got there, which was like this desire to succeed. And it was partly they were negging me, like that's for sure. Like like after pursuing me so hard, they then didn't they wouldn't give me a date to show up. And then when I got there, the attitude was like, oh, did we hire you? Okay, well, see if you can get on the air, I guess. You know, it was like that. And it had the desired effect, you know, of making me like, how do I?
Yeah, fuck me, no fuck you. Yeah. I'll show you. I'll smother you with success.
How do I get on the air, make myself useful? And I did that enough in those four episodes that they then picked me up for nine more for the rest of that season as a featured player. And I, again, like hustled to try and get myself on the air. And meanwhile, like I'm not liking it.
Yeah.
You know, and then they brought me back for a second season, which I think there was a weird thing where some of the more popular cast members were renegotiating their contracts at the point at which my contract came up. So they didn't know who was going to be on the show the next season.
Oh, so they just picked you up as a utility
player. Yeah, they just picked me, exactly. Yeah. And then all those people came to terms and then it was kind of like, it really was genuinely, oh, you're back, huh? Okay. What are you doing again? Like, what are your kind of, do you think, do you have voices or what are you, it was a lot like that. So that whole second season was just, I've got a foot out the door here, clearly.
Yeah.
So that was weird. And I just played a lot of straight man roles, which I enjoyed actually. Like I enjoyed being the grounding element in scenes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought it's an interesting challenge.
Right.
But it's not a way to stand out.
Yeah. It's like being the lineman on the football team. It's just like it's grunt work.
I'm going to assume you're right.
Yeah. It's all just spinal compression. Just repeated
a lot of spinal compression. Yes, yeah. But there were great people. Rich Tallarico worked there. Tammy Sager worked there. Michael Coleman was there at the time.
Yeah, yeah, wow.
Yeah, some very funny people. God, Mo Collins is so funny. Alex Borstein was there.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah. Funny people.
And Blaine was gone by the time he was gone by then. Yeah, he's great.
Yeah.
Well, then, when you were out here, because one thing that always struck me about you that I found out years ago, and I think I found this out just walking by it with you, that you, like, when you first got out here, you bought property.
I did.
You bought a townhouse.
I did.
And that, like, blew my mind, like, to have that. That grown-up presence of mind,
right.
To go from a 1 point whatever, a grade point average, to being a property owner.
Yeah. Well, that I have to credit the woman who is now my wife yet again because I had—
When did you guys start dating?
1998. I was 27.
In New York.
York. Yeah. And so we were long distance at that. She was in New York and I was in L.A. And— I was talking about, I had done a bunch of commercials and I had been on Mad TV now for, you know, whatever, 13 episodes. So I had this money and she was like, well, don't throw money away on rent. You might as well park a bunch of that as a down payment. And then the interest is deductible. Like all the stuff I never would have known.
Right, right.
Her father was an accountant. And,
you know.
So I bought a condo around the corner from what is now the UCB Theater. And that's why the UCB Theater is there because I used to go see shows at that theater which was the Tamarind Theater.
Yeah.
Because I just walk around the corner and see whatever was there. I saw some funny shows. And then when the UCB came to town, they were like, we're looking for a space. And I happened to know that that space was available and that the owners of the theater wanted to lease it out. And so I was like, well, there's a theater around the corner.
Wow.
Because a crazy.
So you're totally in, seeped in real estate at that time.
Well, there was a crazy Greek soap opera star who mounted an extremely expensive production of Hamlet, taking out billboards all around town, and he refurbished the Tamarind Theater as the whatever it was, the Vittorio Silviano Theater, and the Hamlet had one performance and closed because his Greek accent was so thick, nobody could understand a word he was saying.
Oh my God, that's fantastic.
The LA Weekly ran a whole story about this crazy guy in his theater. But so now all of a sudden the theater is empty. He had leased it for a year and then just left town.
Oh really?
Yeah. And so I was paying a lot of attention to the space and just saw, oh, the owners of that theater leased it out for a year to this Greek soap opera star. What's that going to be like? And then, oh, that guy has left town.
Yeah,
He's been run out of town.
Did you see the show? Did you see
it? No, it was one show. And I walked my dog past it, like, as the there were all these champagne bottles. There were like 100 champagne bottles in the lobby. And it was like opening night. And I was like, oh, we're checking that out for sure.
Yeah, but
didn't get our chance.
Not to be. Yeah. And you said we, you mean you and your dog.
Yes. Yeah. Me and the dog.
Yeah. Hey, buddy, we're going in there.
Roker? Rabbit?
Well, so after Mad TV, now, when do you and Carrie, does she move out?
Yeah, she came out like toward the end of that disaster.
Toward the end of
Mad, where the writing is on the wall.
Yeah. And were you engaged?
No, we got engaged about a year after that.
About a year after that, And so what happens after that? Is it just kind of, you know?
Yeah, that was a time when I truly was depressed, which is not something that has happened to me very often in my life. But I was out here. I had committed to this place. I bought this condo. I was done with Mad TV. I did not know. I still had that agent at that time who still didn't want anything to do with me. And I didn't know what to do or where to go or anything. And I somehow managed to survive for 2 years being like, I would audition for the principal role in a commercial and I would get hired for a like background role. it kept happening, but I was getting paid as a principal, but I was in the background of a commercial. That happened a bunch of times.
Yeah.
And then
that was at the time too when that was actually sort of lucrative.
Yeah. And then I was doing bits. I was taking all the bits that had been rejected from Mad TV and turning them into solo performance pieces and doing them.
Were you doing that while you were on Mad TV? Were you still performing out in the world? Yeah.
A little bit, because Matt Besser had come to town and he was given Thursday nights at I.O. West to program. And so he put together a show. It was me and Patton Oswalt and Brian Posehn and Jerry Minor and Matt Besser and Daniel Schneider and Sean Conroy would come and do new material every week was the idea.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would just turn a sketch into a monologue.
Oh, great.
Every Thursday night, which became my album.
But that was your outlet.
Yeah, that was my outlet.
Yeah, yeah. Which the album, if you guys don't know the album Nine Sweaters, pause this and go listen to it. Because it is truly one of my favorite comedy albums of all time. It's really, really fucking funny. Mm. And I've got to see you do those bits live too, which is sort of like, it's sort of like, you know, the differences in them. Like there's, like I saw you do the singing group. What is it?
Oh, the Skip McCabe.
And the Skip Around Gang.
Yeah.
I saw you do the Skip Around Gang live once, and that one is the one that I remember more because it was just like, it was a different one. It was just really meaner and sicker.
Yeah. Than even the one that's on the album.
Yeah. Than the one that's on the album. Yeah. And oh my God, it was about as funny as I've ever seen anything. Yeah. And because I remember seeing you around here too, like doing stuff at the old Largo. Mm-hmm. On Melrose, or I mean on Fairfax.
Yeah.
And like, I remember one night you did something, You came up and you were just a stand-up comedian that never got to anything.
Yeah, right.
Was there a name for that?
Yeah,
bit?
I call him Jerry O'Hearn.
Jerry O'Hearn. Mm-hmm. And is that's not on the album, though.
It's on the album as a bonus track, but it was on the Comedy Death Ray album.
Oh,
Comedy
okay.
Death Ray put it on an album.
Because, oh my God, it's just like I couldn't believe it because you do absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I never could say anything.
Fucking screaming. It's all stuff like, have you been, I mean, come on, the world's crazy. Right. And just like that. And
did you see this? This was interesting. I mean, these people are like, you know, walking around going, hey, what about this? I'm sitting here going, all right, knock it off. You know what? It's just like, what are you talking about?
Oh my God. I fucking howled when I saw that. I was like, oh my God.
I remember that night at Largo.
I never laughed at nothing more than that.
Yeah. It went well that night at Largo.
Yeah.
That's a fun. And that came from a bit that Andy Secunda and I used to do on the subway where I would challenge myself on the ride from like Union Square out to the Lorimer Street stop on the L to talk for as long as I could without ever getting to a point, just to see if I could. I'd just be on the pale at this point. For someone to say that to me, I mean, here I am going, what is happening? You know, just in that voice, just for fun.
Yeah. so funny. Can't you tell my love's a growing? So that becomes the album?
Yeah.
And then what stops the dry spell?
It was, again, Matt Besser. He created the show Crossballs for Comedy Central and asked me to be on it. And that was like, what's the way to say it? It just washed away all of the Mad TV self-doubt and the square peg round hole of that because it was... That was a great show because I'm coming on as a character with a ridiculous point of view that I'm trying to convince a real person that I am an actual person who truly believes this. And so it was just such an exercise in burying your punchlines.
Yes,
you know what
yes.
I mean? And
not being overtly jokey.
Yes.
Yeah.
The last thing you want them to do is say, oh, this is a comedian. And
this is a bit.
Yeah. And we had written really, really funny things for me to say, you know, for everybody to say. And so to just kind of deliver a punchline in a way that the person would never guess that it was a pre-written jokey punchline was a wonderful wonderful experience.
Yeah, that show, I mean, for people who don't know that show, I don't know if it exists anywhere.
I think—
Maybe Comedy Central website or something,
I recall Besser put it online somewhere. Maybe it's UCB Comedy or YouTube or something.
It was meant to be a point-counterpoint show with real—there would be one real panelist assuming one view and then a ridiculous character assuming just a ridiculous opposing point.
Right.
Which it is the kind of comedy though that makes me so uncomfortable as someone that's so nervous about pranks.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
Oh my God. Whenever I prank, I just identify with the pranker or the prankee, not the pranker, and it just I feel like, oh, this poor person. Mm-hmm. They're just living their lives, and we're laughing at like how. Ha ha, they don't get it. Like, well, why would they?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, there was an attempt on that show to bring in people who, in one way or another, kind of deserved
assholes,
it. They were
kind of
asking for it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember the day that we were writing this show and having so much fun, and it suddenly dawned on me, oh, there's also going to be a real person there who's getting screwed over.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wish that element wasn't here because this is a really funny sketch show without that.
Yeah. And you did, there was an, the one thing that stands out to me from that show, aside from how funny and uncomfortable it was, you know, the two things like both being wonderfully in equal proportion, was that you played an old man and I don't think you had any makeup on.
No, I had no makeup.
You just had like a bucket hat.
Yeah.
And
a thick
bad
pair
lighting
of glasses.
And a thick pair of glasses, and you played this filthy old man.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just
and
amazed.
And I was sitting next to an actual old woman who was my wife.
And nobody could believe it. Nobody questioned the fact, like, no, that guy's 34 years old
exactly.
or 33 years old.
That's about right.
Oh, that was amazing.
I remember he was talking about how senior citizens are better drivers than young people. And one of the lines was, I'm not going to get distracted by seeing a friend on the street because everybody I know is dead.
Oh my God, that was fantastic. So and then from there, how long until review?
A long time. That was 2004. And then the next year I got to do that episode of The Office and then Sammy Pro, which we did together.
Oh, right.
Which
yep.
Had so much fun working with you on
that. That was a lot of fun.
That was a fun movie.
We were stuck for about 4 weeks?
Yep.
That all the basketball scenes were shot in a armory that is on the, like an armory fire department kind of training facility that's right down the hill from Dodger Stadium. Mm-hmm. And you, Will Arnett, and me were basically background for a month while they did all the basketball scenes.
Yes, but the funny thing is that Kent left the mics open.
Kent Alterman,
who directed it, for an entire month. And Will and I would just, like, I don't know if anybody's listening, but we, in character, would just fuck around on the mics all the time. And a lot of that is in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, because I was the team manager. So I had to sit there like I was the timekeeper. Mm-hmm. And there was no mic on me. I just sat there growing ass pimples because of my polyester pants on the Naugahyde chair. It was gross. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was really like a unique, fun time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Had a bear on the set, and that bear went on to kill somebody.
Yes, I remember.
Oh, boy. Animals people, they're the best.
And then it was Eastbound and Down.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And then, you know.
And movies in there, the Yogi Bear Yogi movie. Bear. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I still recommend the Yogi Bear movie just because you're so fucking funny in it as like the villain in it.
Oh, man.
You're the best part of it, you know?
Thank you. Well, one of my heroes is Charles Grodin. I watched all of his villain turns.
I
don't say that I resemble or anything like his performances at all, but
he was inspired by it.
Yes.
Or you stole things from him.
Here and there, yeah.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
He's so good in Heaven Can Wait. People should check that out.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen Heaven Can Wait. Good Lord, he's so funny in that.
He really is.
And then Review really came around in like 2010, 2011. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of was the beginning of that.
And it was
process.
An Australian show.
Yes, it was an Australian show. And for me, just on my doorstep, there were some DVDs of this Australian show with no explanation from my agency. And I popped them in and watched them. I was like, oh, yeah, I could do that. That guy's doing, I could be that guy. Is that what this is about?
Yeah, yeah.
That he called?
And the concept of the show for people who haven't seen it, which you should also, it's on
DVD.
Oh,
yes, it just came out on DVD.
It's on DVD.
It took me 4 years to get it out on DVD.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. Hard work.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to put
out
a coffee table book of all the emails that I've sent and received on the subject of getting this DVD out over 4 years as I was passed from one team to another. It was like, Viacom has shuffled those people out of the organization that you've been talking to.
Yeah, you're now dealing with Kraft Foods. to explain the concept of that show.
So it is a reviewer. Who doesn't review foods, books, or movies. He reviews life experiences. And so the audience – and it's all scripted comedy. The audience members write in and say, what's it like to get struck by lightning? What's it like to divorce your wife? What's it like – you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And he just with the integrity of a scientist heads out into the world to do these things with no regard for the impact – that these things will have on his own life or the life of others in his world. And also no regard for the fact that this is a completely unscientific and worthless exercise that never dawns on
him. Right. That it's because it does and it elevates and elevates and elevates and it does a really nice job of being episodic and serial at the same time, where there is like you watch any one episode and there is just like enough of that concept that's kind of fun. Mm. But then there is like when it's like, what's it like to get a divorce? And there's that. And it was what episode is that? Like
three.
Mm-hmm. And then you realize like, oh, no, this is not like just some sort of lark that this show is doing. Like, no, this guy is really going to divorce his wife and leave his wife and child.
Mm-hmm.
And it just was it just gets really fucking serious and crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I knew when I first saw the show, I was like, well, that's what's going to be funny about it is if, like, he's doing these life experiences and it doesn't reset. Like a cartoon, it's cumulative. These things happen in his life. If he gets a tattoo, we'll see it the rest of the series.
Yeah.
You know, and And I knew that we wanted him to divorce his wife largely so that he could have adventures in the world that a married man wouldn't, was kind of the original thought.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Australians did it too. But it was Jeff Blitz, in the Andy Blitz's older brother, the Emmy-winning director and Oscar-nominated director, who helped run the show with me, who was really like, him divorcing his wife is only going to be funny if we really, really feel that he would never do it except for the show, that he, this is the love of his life, and he's only divorcing her because of this stupid television show. And if that is true, then in the next episode, he would still be trying to get her back. You know what I mean? And that would never end. And so it became, I didn't realize I was getting myself into this like demented love story. I never expected. I thought, you know, get rid of the wife in episode 3 so he can go to orgies. But but it's true that like from here on out, if it's true that he only divorced her for the show and would love to get back together with her, then that's going to inform everything going forward. And it just made the show like so tragic and so heavy and so fun.
Because he's so committed to this stupid, stupid idea of what he's is, you know, his raison d'etre is, you know?
Yeah.
Oh. And I remember too somebody, because I really loved the show. I just kind of was enjoying it on the face value of it being a comedy about an idiot. But it,
and a narcissist.
Yes, but that was. But then there was a review that I think you put online where somebody mentioned that like this show is about white male privilege. Mm-hmm. This show is about how far up their own asses white men live that they think that their particular whatever their particular goal is or whatever their particular crusade is is so important, and it's not and they are willing to burn down the world for this.
Yeah, we always said that Forrest McNeil, the character in review, had no doubt that he had the term we always use was unique insights.
Yes.
He was possessed of unique insights into the human experience, despite having no relevant background or education or, you know, no, there's no evidence that he has any special ability to do this. It's just something he believes. And on the strength of that belief, everything can burn down.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And does.
And does.
And does.
Yeah.
I mean, like... he kills his father-in-law or his father-in-law?
Oh, yes, he kills his father-in-law.
Just fucking awesome.
In space.
So awesome. That is one of the funniest fucking side gags I've ever seen.
Do you know, I'll tell you what that was based on. I think it's okay to reveal this. Jeff Blitz, it was Steve Carell, took his family on a helicopter tour of the Grand Canyon. You know, you can do that. You can get in a helicopter.
Yeah, sure.
And the company that did the tour then gave them a DVD when it's over, which is it cuts just sort of automatically, like on a timer, between the family in the helicopter looking down and going, wow, and then the view. There's a camera on the underside of the helicopter, the view of the Grand Canyon. It just goes back and forth and back and forth. And one of Steve Carell's kids was vomiting the entire time. So so the video goes from these beautiful, tranquil shots of the Grand Canyon to a kid vomiting and everybody like reacting to vomit. And is there a bag? Do you have a bag? I've got wipes. I think I have wipes in my purse. And chaos of that. And then the beautiful view of the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
It's just hilarious. And so when we decided that, we were going to kill Fred Willard in space, that was the original idea. And I don't even know if we ended up doing that. Cutting to the beautiful view of Earth from orbit and then cutting back into the cabin to see like a corpse floating around zero gravity.
Oh, it's so funny. Now, were you aware of like sort of the greater implications of it? Like, do you at some point go, this is about male ego and this is, you know, or are you just kind of like.
I was quite focused on it, on playing his commitment and his narcissism and his blindness and his stupidity. And I was also aware that it was very much a work-life balance story. But no, I would say it had to be pointed out to me that it is a story about like, the mediocrity of mediocrity and self-delusions and ego of a white male.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I see, because I think that's like I asked when he was on the show once, Vince Gilligan, about Breaking Bad, because you know how Walter White sort of turns into a sociopath.
Sure.
You know, I mean, and not just, you know, but like you see like that episode where you see his college friends yes. that went on to have a business and you realize like, oh, he's fucking broken. Like he's – and mm-hmm. I asked him, I said, did you set out with that intention? He goes, no, no, that was – we discovered that along mm-hmm. the way. And I just kind of – that's like what's to me about making – narrative television like that that's so exciting is that you can just be in this vehicle and trying to just deal with the truth of this thing, and then you're creating something that is just like its own organic form,
yeah.
like growing like, you know, crystals in a cave or something.
It is that if this is true, then this is also true.
Yeah.
If you're going to say that, then you have to follow it through to this. And in Breaking Bad, like the fact that when they reveal that he could have gotten that money from another source,
yeah.
like that's kind of the moment when yep. me as an audience member, I go, oh, he wants to be doing this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. you know? He is not, yeah, he mm-hmm. is truly an anti-hero. He is a mm-hmm. bad person.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty great. Mm-hmm. Anyway, check out Breaking Bad.
Well, it's also available on DVD, probably.
We're winding up here pretty quick. But I want to talk to you just about fatherhood, like what, you know, what fatherhood has done for you. I mean, you know, how you kind of cope with it, how you, you know. I've never really asked anybody that before.
Oh.
But I just, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's just I feel like you're not a very good father.
I'm a terrible father.
So I want to see just, you know, I want to poke around in there, see if I can't find any abscesses.
Fatherhood has been extraordinary to me. It's so funny to me when I think of what I thought fatherhood was going to be when we were thinking of having kids. I guess I was just in a state of denial. I was kind of like, it's not going to change much about my life, what I'm doing with my life, who I am. You know, this will just be another person in our group and
in our group.
yeah. And if there's like, you know, if there's any needs, I can throw money at it. We can hire a nanny, can't we? And we can just like, you know, just address all of this in a way that my style is not going to be cramped. And then there's a period of realizing, oh no, it's a complete change of every minute of my day.
Mm-hmm. Your old life is over.
It is over. Yes.
If you do it right.
Yeah.
Some people do throw money at it and just kind of like, oh, that it's like a dog that they kind of regret having,
uh-huh.
you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not even fucking exaggerating
with some
of the people that I've known out here, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Who are unwilling to allow the fact that they've had a child change their life significantly.
Right.
But it completely changed my life. And there was a period of like, resenting that, to be honest,
sure.
you know, followed by a period of just of gradually, not even deciding, but gradually understanding that this is the important thing. This is the important
thing. Right, exactly.
And now it's like when I think about my career or money or anything, it's entirely about them. It's that's the whole reason I'm leaving the house or staying in the house or doing anything. Is giving, making them happy, making them comfortable, making them love themselves and be prepared to head into the world and do and understand themselves. And for me to try and understand them as well as I can, which is really a lot. It's a lot of work to understand a developing person is takes a lot of.
And also because you don't really know, like I've told my son, who's my oldest, like everything we go through, because he's a college freshman now. Mm-hmm. Your mom and I've never had a college freshman before,
right?
So I don't, you know, and there will be times when he's called me this year with one problem or another, or one sort of stressor of another. And I'm like, what do I do? I got to just go with my instincts here. And like, and, you know, have done pretty well. But it is like you are met as a parent with times of like, holy fuck, I don't know what to say to this kid.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do, but I can't let them know because – this is my job, and I don't want them to know that they're rudderless, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely do a lot of like sympathizing,
but
without solving.
Yes. You know? That's important.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because you can't, you know.
Yeah. I don't want to come on like I know things I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I also think, too, that like what you said, that's what it's about. Like having your family and your kids and your life outside of all of this that we just talked about for an hour and a half, that's the important stuff. And I do think that really coming to terms with that and where you just think what you do with your kids and your life with your family – how important that is, how it's really, truly the only important thing. And it makes all this other stuff so silly, all this showbiz stuff, all this Hollywood shit, all this publicity or whatever, or am I going to get this job or where's my career going? It makes it all seem so silly and so like such frippery, you know? Yeah. And I honestly think that that makes you better at it. That makes your work better. That if you can honestly think about the nonsense of this business with a healthy perspective on it, you're just going to be better at it.
Oh, yeah.
You're just going to do better. You're just – people are going to want to see your stuff more, you know, which is – you can't fake it, but, you know, because I do see people who – a lot of this shit is just too important to them.
Yeah.
It's like it doesn't fucking matter.
Right.
I've told people – I mean people have told it back to me, like – people leaving the set at you know, after a Conan appearance, all nervous and worried. And I've told numerous people, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's just a fucking talk show appearance. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
You know, there's no scientific formula that it's like you're actually affecting anything.
Yeah. So you might as well relax and enjoy
theaters, you know, like your movie crashed because you weren't that funny on Conan.
Right.
It's like, no, none of it matters. All that matters is your experience that you had going through it. Because especially in a show like this, that's all people want to see.
Yeah.
Is somebody really existing and really experiencing something that they're in. And like I say, you can't force that, but it is like, I was trying to tell people so that they can kind of maybe come around to that notion because it's what makes it best.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I do think like when you feel like you have your priorities right, you're not wasting time out of the house. So I'm only doing things that I really love to do or that I got to do for money.
Yeah.
That's it.
And the got to do for money is fine too.
Great.
Yeah. No problem. All right. You know?
Sure.
Because, you know, like, I'm not tearing out chunks of my soul for this. I'm just, you know, I'll do you a good job. It's important to me to do a good job.
Oh, but
I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to sweat it and think, like, is this, I'm going to make this Bennigan's the best Bennigan's, you know. There's a lot of showbiz versions of somebody going, like, this Bennigan's has got to be the best. No, it doesn't. They'll be fine. People will get their apps, you know. Don't worry. Well, the second question of this is, where are you going?
The second question.
Yeah. This was all the first question. This is the first question. Oh, you did fine.
Yeah. Oh, that was the first question.
Yeah.
All right. Wow. Feels like there had a bit more than one question in there. Where am I going? I don't know.
You don't know?
No.
You don't, is there a dream project you got sitting aside?
Yeah. Well, I'm developing right now an animated project that I'm so excited about and a live action project. But there is one kind of nagging at me. I have a friend who is a visual artist and apparently quite successful in that world. She tells me, which is up to, it sounds fancy. And at some point she said, well, this gallery in Germany is doing a midlife retrospective on me. And I was like, oh no, not midlife, mid-career, a mid-career retrospective. And I was like, oh, I like that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And so it's got me percolating on some kind of a one-man show that's sort of, you know, structured. Let us appraise.
And that would be like fake autobiographical, like it would be about you as a...
Yeah. This is my mid-career retrospective.
That would be good. What an asshole.
And it goes back to Charles Grodin in a way, because Charles Grodin did a one-man show just about his adventures in show business that became his memoir, which is now out of print, but you can find it.
It would be so nice if you weren't here.
Yes.
It's really a great book.
It's my favorite.
I mean, he ended up turning into a fucking nightmare.
Yes, and you can see the early signs of that in this memoir, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it is stories of times where he just was unreasonable.
Yeah.
And proudly unreasonable.
One thing I always love from that book is that he talks about when he went to very serious acting classes in New York City, and they would give him these exercises, and he would go, Why?
Yes.
Like, why? Why would we do that? What is this doing? And yeah. they would have no answer for him. And then he would refuse to do it. Like,
to
be
do
a
it.
Tree or whatever fucking yeah. bullshit. Or, like, you know, make the noise that anger may. And you just be like, why? I want to learn how to learn lines, you right. know, tell stories. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of did, you kind of had a little bit of advice, kind of like, you know, what you've learned kind of thing. I mean, we sort of learned that, talked about it, you know, with the parenting thing.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, is there something that you kind of wish you could tell maybe like a younger, your younger self or, you know, whether it's about this nonsense or whether it's about being a husband or
yeah.
a father or, you know.
I've so many people say this, I guess, but I would definitely tell my younger self to relax.
Yeah.
Don't worry so much
yeah.
about the future.
And,
yeah. you know, don't try to be guided as much by hopes, more by hopes than by fears.
Yes.
You know, because when I think of my early days of having no idea what was coming, there was not a lot of, oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be this. There was a lot of, but what if it's this?
Yeah,
what
yeah,
if that
yeah.
happens? What? And running away from frightening things.
Yeah.
You know, and it would just be, it was just a lot of wasted time and worry and, you know.
Yeah. I've said about that, I would tell myself, like somebody, we did a live version of this show with Rachel Dratch up in San Francisco, and somebody asked us, what would you tell your younger selves? And like my own, and this is 100% true. It's not just, it's a joke, yeah, but it's also, it's like, learn to like cardio more. Just
oh, yeah.
learn to like cardio yeah. more. And that's like about as good an advice I could give any young, just if
yeah.
you don't like cardio, learn
Find
to
a
like,
way to
it,
like
a little,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Learn to like it a little, it'll be worth it. But I also, the other thing that I is like, because I think back on the younger me, like, and I was so afraid all
yeah.
the time
mm-hmm.
about what, and I don't know what I was afraid of, but I don't know if I could go back and not be afraid.
Yeah.
I think that like, that coming to the notion that this fear was silly
mm-hmm.
is only because you experienced the fear.
Yes.
And that if you were 26 and, you know, in a condo on Glendale Boulevard and mm-hmm. being like, it's all going to be fine.
Yeah.
You know,
right. You're
you
right.
don't know that you'd be
I needed some fear to propel
you'd
me.
You'd be in the same place,
yeah,
you know?
It's true.
I think that just like there's so much ache and misery and kind of, you know,
mm-hmm.
stomach acid needs to be produced in order to get to a place where you know what you're doing.
Yes. But maybe here's another way to put it is there is no point predicting. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's another thing. Like, because when I imagine what I thought was going to happen 20 years ago, I would not have imagined that they're, all, you know, streaming and, you know, all this, everything
sure.
that this business is and that you can be working and somewhat recognizable and have a fan base but not be famous. Like, you
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah, you can make a living. There's
yeah.
a place for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I love you.
Oh,
I love you very much.
Thank
and you're
you.
One of my favorite people.
Mm.
And thank God you're talented.
Oh.
Because it would be rough for me if I loved you as much as I do and you weren't talented and I have to butter you up and I would feel like such a fucking liar.
But you'd do it.
I would.
Thank you.
I would. No, shit. I, you know, listen. Yeah, I got it. You know, it's, I can't sit here and, you know, and be like, you're good. You know, I gotta really butter you up. So anyways, but to plug.
Oh, yeah.
Review on DVD.
Yes.
Pick that
Amazon.
Shit up.
It's available on Amazon.
Amazon.
Only.
Your new podcast.
My new podcast, Bananas for Bonanza with Dalton Wilcox, coming eventually.
Eventually.
I have a new album coming out in May, I think.
Oh, sweet.
Yes, it's called Four More Sweaters.
Nice.
Monsters Take Your Questions. And it's recorded at the UCB Theater where the audience ask my characters questions.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's a Q&A.
A lot of fun.
Yes.
And then, but you have existing, do you still have the Cabinet of Curiosities? Are you still doing that podcast?
Oh, no. We're going to probably do another season of that,
I hope.
But currently there are not new episodes of that dropping.
All right. Well, they exist.
They exist. Yeah.
It's a funny show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cabinet of, what is it called? The Great American Cabinet of Curiosities.
But that's not, don't look for it like that because it is hilariously misnamed on all platforms.
Oh, yeah. It's hard to find on Twitter and Instagram, yeah. But it's there on Stitcher under that
title. Good job. You're a real fucking businessman. All right. Well, thank you so much, Andy.
Thank you.
And love to you and yours.
Likewise.
And all you folks out there, love to you and yours, too.
Aww.
Good
anyway. Thing they're talented, too.
Yeah, no shit. If you people weren't talented enough to know to listen to this stuff, I don't know what I'd do.
Lie.
Yeah, lie. We'll be back next time with more Three Questions. Thanks for listening. Big, big love.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It's produced by me, Kevin Bartelt, executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Chris Bannon and Colin Anderson at Earwolf. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, associate produced by Jen Samples and Galit Sahayak, and engineered by Will Becton. And if you haven't already, make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production. In association with Earwolf.